accession number 26560, reel 8.
Mr. Nicol, reel 8. We're talking about your time out in Korea, and we've sort of gone on to a general phase. We were just talking about people that made an impression on you. Were there any other characters that affected you or that you remember?
Well, when you talk about an impression, it's usually sort of looking for a good impression or an indifferent impression. We had a chap from London called Al Morris. He was a rag and bone man.
Albert,
his name was. And he was a rag and bone man in Dagenham. And he was quite talented in that he could fight, he could play the piano, he could sing. And there wasn't much he couldn't do. But the problem was that there isn't anything he wouldn't do.
What do you mean?
Well, you see, we had another character called Scotty, as we called him. He's now dead. He was a
private
big pound,
Scott,
private.
Then.
No, he's a corporal.
Corporal,
yeah.
Sir, first name, do you know?
Tony. Yeah. Well, Tony and Morris, when they were both privates before Tony got made up. They just went on what we call on the trot. They deserted. This was in England, actually. They robbed a shop in Colchester, gorged themselves on chocolate and stuff, went to sleep in the shop, and then when the owner come in the morning, they were still there asleep. So, you know, this is sort of stupid things they used to do. Morris used to strut about the camp and act like a policeman, and I mean he could take people off, he could mimic people, he could take the officers off. You know, he was a real comedian, he was a real character. You know, you couldn't leave anything, put anything down near him because he'd pinch it. That was just his nature, you know. I remember Scotty in when we got back to Hong Kong, his mother sent him £50, which was a lot of money in those days, to buy a suit. Well, the £50 went, and we always did think that, you know, probably Morris had it, but we couldn't really say that because we didn't know. But, you know, he was a rogue, but one of those lovable rogues. Scotty was a bit of a madman, especially in Korea. I think he went a little bit bomb happy in Korea.
In what way?
Well, I got on with him ever so well. But he'd say things like to somebody, "Let's have a knife fight." But he meant it. I mean, he would have done it. The other guy said, "Yes, I'll go with that." They'd have had a knife fight. I mean, he was that sort of guy. Other than that, he was straight, and he was a good lad.
What about any particular friends of your own in your section or just mates? You know?
Well, Nobby Clark, well, Buzz Clark, Basil Clark.
He was your number two.
Yeah, and he was sort of and he shared, you know, the living quarters with me.
Now, what was he like? Tell us a bit about Nobby.
Well, Buzz is a real country
Buzz,
lad.
That's his nickname, isn't
well,
it?
Well, Buzz, yeah, we called him Nobby, but Buzz is short for Basil. He lives out in the wild in Norfolk. I mean, it's difficult to find the place. Something St. Margaret's, it's not far from this. I think there's six houses where he lives and a church. Spent all his life in the country. Spent all his life there since he left the army. Married a local girl. Lived locally, worked locally, but salt of the earth, good lad. And we meet up. In fact, I've got some tickets I've got to send him for a parade we're having at Ely, and he'll come up with his wife, and we meet up and have a drink, you know, and a
And he was, was he your best mate out there, or were there others?
Well, I don't know about best mate. You see, it was difficult because although we were there and we were all together, it was an NCO. So there was a little bit of a barrier, if you like, that you sort of couldn't quite cross, if you like. He came out of the army, and to what sort of guy he is, he decided he'd like to do a parachute jump.
This is Basil.
Yeah. He did four. And I believe it's four, and then he did so many free fall. That sort of guy he was, you know. Yeah. Yeah, he was an old country lad, and you'd think, unless you knew him, you'd think he was just a simple country boy, but no. You know. Very reliable, you know. If we'd have been in real trouble out there, I would have relied on him to sort of get me out, you know.
Now, what about any other things? I mean, did you get leave in Japan? Yeah, there?
Yeah, there was one other character in the in the company, Bert Smith.
A private or?
Oh yeah, private. He would always be a private, Bert would.
What was he like?
He came from London. He was in the Assault Pioneers. He was loud. And he'd hit you as soon as look at you. He was one of those sort of guys, you know. And he became a professional boxer after he left the army. And I don't quite know what happened to him and how well he did or whether he's still alive. But Bert did 3 months on field punishment for banging a lance corporal. He's a pretty hard case in the company. So he was well known, you know. I mean, people like that did get to sort of did get a name, and people did sort of recognise him, you know. I mean, every officer, every man in the battalion knew Bert Smith, you know. And nobody stood sideways to him, either, you know. He was that sort of guy.
Now, what about leave in Japan? Did you get leave?
Yes,
I... You were sent in turn, weren't you?
Yeah. I took... I had Tokyo leave, and that would be in the summer of 52. Early 52.
And what do you remember about him?
Well, I remember getting on the plane and sort of more or less falling off, you know, because we were taken down to Incheon, I suppose it would be, Seoul, where there was an American air base, and we were flown in an American Skymaster to Tokyo, and they used to fill the planes up so badly and so full that usually by the time you got on the plane you'd had a fair bit to drink, you know. And I do remember getting on the plane and one of the air crew came along and said, look, you people at back, you'll have to get down the front, otherwise we'll never get off the runway. You know, cheering thought, you know, we all had to get up, walk up to the front and hang on the front so you get his tail off the ground, you know. And we went to a camp in where they're called Ebisu, which was just outside Tokyo. It was sort of a train journey into Tokyo for 5 days, where we really lived in the lap of luxury, you know, sort of lovely clean white towels and baths and showers and good food, and girls waited on the tables and brought you food, you know. And you just had a free hand, you know. You just had a free hand because there was no restrictions. You booked into the camp and you booked out on the fifth day, and that's all they really wanted to know, you know. And I sent quite a few gifts home from there, and the Japanese were so honest. You could go into a shop and buy something and say, will you post it home for me? And they'd obviously make a charge, and everything I did, you know, had done this way, everything got home. They were so honest.
What sort of gifts would you buy?
Well, I think I sent you some pyjamas, didn't I, love?
Yeah.
I sent my mum a cigarette box, ashtray, and a sort of a lighter with all fancy of the Fujiyama, you know. Obviously tasteless things, you know, really.
Tea service.
And the tea service was from Hong Kong, love. Things like that, you know, but...
And how did you get on with the Japanese journey? Is this only 6-7 years after
that's
the war?
Right. And I was so surprised that... I've got to say, you know, in the Far East, the Japanese were the best people I ever met.
In what way? What was so good about
them? Well, they were so honest, so polite, and they sort of meant what they said. When I first got there and talked to one and they bowed and I thought, well, I don't like this, but after a while you find that you bow back and it's a custom they have. And I got stuck, for instance, during my leave, I had to change trains at Shimbashi or somewhere like that, going from Tokyo back to Ebisu, and I was absolutely stuck on this station with all these trains coming in and going, hundreds and hundreds of people, and I must have looked pretty sort of bewildered. And a Japanese businessman walked up to me and he sort of said, you want to go to Ebisu? And I said, yeah. And he actually took me to the platform and said, not the first train, the second train. And, you know, that's got to impress you, hasn't it, you know. And they were so friendly and really in Kure, because it wasn't far from Hiroshima. There are a lot of people that had been affected by the atom bomb. Big blue burns and that, you know. And even they weren't bitter. You know, and they really did impress me.
Mm. Now, we did a lot of drinking.
Well, you do your share, but I can't say we sort of drank all day. The two chaps I went with were from our stores, and they were pretty steady-going fellas, so... No, we sort of relaxed and had a drink and had some good food and had a real good look around Tokyo, you know.
So just enjoyed yourself?
Just enjoyed and relaxed, you know, that's it, really.
No, so I'm sort of coming to the end of career. So you've been on leave and you're in the summer positions. Anything much else? I know there was a big drive to take a prisoner, but I can't think that would involve you.
There was always a big drive to take a prisoner. And we never did take one, you know. And
now, they always seem to die, and it wasn't that there were anything was being done to them.
No,
as far as I can see, were you aware of all this?
Yeah, I was aware of it. I mean, it was so important to our battalion for some unknown reason that in the winter position, on guard at night, if we heard anything on the wire or anything, we had to say "Tao Shan," which was Chinese for surrender, was it? Hopefully that they would say yes or put their hands up or something, and we'd have a prisoner, but it never happened, you know. But Tao Shan, I remember that. And in the middle of the night, you'd hear somebody say, Tao Shan, Tao Shan, you know, because I'd heard a noise. quite funny, really, but no. I don't know why, but we had two or three just die on us, apparently.
But no, you didn't see them?
No.
Anything else happened that summer? It was sort of coming to an end, wasn't it?
Well, it was, yes. I mean, apart from our sort of daily trip to the stream, and that, I mean, it was a very easy-going life.
What was the daily trip to the stream?
Right? Well, to do your washing, or, you know, have a wash, or have a bath. Every now and again, we get...
Was that the actual in gym?
No, that was a stream down through the valley.
Right.
No, the engine was a bit further away, and we used to get a truck come up, and he'd say, the sergeant would say, four of you can go swimming if you want to, you know. And
what was it like swimming in the engine? I mean, was it safe? with the snakes or whatever, water snakes or leeches?
No leeches, no, it was too fast flowing. In the summer months, I suppose, I'm guessing though, because we never did go across the middle, that it would be perhaps 20 feet deep in the middle. But in the spring, when the snow's melted, it would be perhaps 50 or 60 feet deep, moving so hard, you know.
Well, you wouldn't go in it then.
No. But, I mean, it was, when we went in, it was in the summer, and the water was fairly low, and it was safe. And there were sort of little sort of places that were sort of, the water wasn't flowing right through little, and it was just eddying, and they were like big bug pools, you know, and we used to go in there and be fine.
Anything else before we leave?
We used to try and catch snakes on our summer position.
What, up on the hills?
Yeah.
Now, tell me about snakes. I mean, did you know what they were, or was there a problem with them?
We didn't know what they were, no, not really. They were very small. We thought that they were bootlace snakes, but, I mean, I think it was just something somebody dreamt up, because they were so small, they said they've got to be bootlace snakes, they've got to be deadly, you know. And we had a clearing. In the afternoon, the sun used to get on it, and these snakes used to come out to sun themselves. You know, we used to try and creep up on them. But these were the sort of things you did. We had scorpions, not many, but we had black scorpions, and they would be about 6 or 7 inches long. 2 inches high across the part of the body, and with a curly tail as a scorpion has, and they were absolutely jet black. We had those.
Were they a problem?
No. I mean, you had to go look for them. You're lucky if you found them. But
they didn't. So there was
no. No, they didn't come attack you. No. There were quite a lot of pheasants out there. Quite a lot of wild boar.
Now, was there any killing of these for food, or were they no one?
Well, we once watched a Korean. A boar ran into a minefield and blew itself, and he just ran in and picked it up and ran out again. You know, it was just, you know, there but for the grace of God, sort of thing. He was lucky. No, we used to go after deer. There used to be quite a lot of deer in Korea. And when we were in reserve, we used to go out late afternoon, early evening, and sort of try and hunt these deer, you know, to try and get them. And we got one. During the winter, somebody shot a deer, and they sent us up some venison. And I don't know how old this beast must have been, donkey's years old. We boiled it, and we stewed it, and it was still like leather, you know. So that finished me on venison.
Now, how were you pulled out? What happened? I mean, what happened when you were pulled out? How was it, the lead up to it?
The finish. Well, it was just the end of our
time. Unless there's anything else you recall.
No, not really. It was just the end of our time. I'm going to tell you something now that did happen, but it was not very complimentary. But when we were moving position, we were taken over by Canadians. And when they came up, we obviously removed our gun and tripod, and they, you know, dropped their tripod in the same position and put their gun on, so that, you know, the all the settings and everything else would be virtually identical. But they all had American steel helmets on. And we said, well, if you're Canadians, why have you got Yankee hats on? And they said, it's to try and draw the Taiwanese to attack us. Now, I don't think that perhaps ought to go in my print, but that's what they said, and they were disgusted. That was it.
In other words, the Chinese hated the Americans, so they did more likely
attack. Well, they they gave the impression that the Americans were more of a pushover than the Canadians or the Brits. They didn't take us. It was said the Chinese thought that the Royal Norfolks were a crack regiment, but that could have just been sort of, you know, hearsay, really.
So what happened when you pulled back? Did anything happen on the journey back to Busan? Did you go back to Busan?
Yeah, we caught a train. We were coming out of action, and the sergeants then decided they weren't in danger anymore. And they were going to put the pressure on to get the old discipline back, you know. This was on the train. And if the train stopped, you had to get out with a loaded weapon to make sure that nobody attacked the train, you see. And Warner, Sergeant Warner, Scotty and Morris were out together, and he, Warner jumped out of the train, and there was an argument, and they threatened to shoot him, and Scotty would have done, you know. that was one incident, you know. We then went down to Busan, went into transit, and then we caught a boat. Excuse me. To Hong Kong. I can't remember the name of that boat. And we then was sent up to Fanling, a camp in Fanling. And
Fanling camp.
Fanling, yeah.
And that's in the New Territories, isn't it?
Yes, not far from the actual wire. I can't remember the name of the camp now. It was in Fanling, anyway.
I think there is one called Fanling camp.
Well, it might have been. I know the village was called Fanling.
And what were you doing there? What was the setup there?
Well, getting back to being a sort of a bull unit, if you like, you know, a battalion. You know, you're here and you're going to sort of get back, you're going to bull your boots and you're going to press your uniforms and you're going to parade, and totally different life, you know. The machine gun is at the moment is very secondary, that sort of attitude, you know, because no doubt, you know, we had got a bit sort of undisciplined, you know. We'd virtually sort of kept our noses clean, but otherwise done as we really, as much as we wanted to do, you know.
Did you mind them doing this? Or?
No, I didn't, because I liked soldiering. I liked that side of soldiering anyway. And I quite like dressing up and bullying up and parading and drill. I quite liked it, yeah.
And what else were you doing there?
We used to do patrols, patrols and digging positions up on the border.
And tell us about that. That's on the Chinese border.
Yeah, we used to go up there. I think sort of companies around the battalion, and I can't remember much about this, kept had turns, and we used to go up and either dig positions or put up wire fences and whatnot, and then during the day we'd take, or they'd bring up what were they called, haversack rations, which we used to feed mainly to the Chinese children, because they'd, you know, come the little sorry, but they'd come with their little tins with a handle on, you know, and we'd give them a great big thick cheese sandwich, like doorsteps, you know, and they'd scuttle off home with it, you know, because they were pretty hungry. Bit of training, not much really.
What type of training?
Well, a bit on the machine gun, not really much, but really it was a time of knocking the battalion back into shape, I think, anyway. We saw a lot more of Gilchrist, obviously. He strutted his stuff, you know, and pull people up and make them do us, you know, what soldiers should be doing. At the weekend we could have a 36-hour pass and you could go into Hong Kong.
What was that like?
Well, Hong Kong, I didn't like Hong Kong very much. I liked Kowloon, which is on the mainland.
Now, why didn't you like Hong Kong? It
seemed too commercialised. Kowloon was more traditional, I would say. The Nathan Road was the main sort of street running all the way sort of through Kowloon. And it was very interesting. Didn't particularly like the Chinese because we'd just been fighting them, but that was a bit of sort of, you know, bias really.
Was that as far as all, except the kids, obviously?
Well, yeah, you know, you can't dislike children, can you? But I wouldn't.
So you extended that in a sense to all the Hong Kong, because they're all Chinese as well.
Yeah, that's right. Really. I never did trust any of them really, you know. Whereas I said, I trusted the Japanese, but I wouldn't. I didn't, and I wouldn't still trust
the
Chinese.
Did that lead to any trouble, or was it just that you didn't make
it? No, the only trouble we ever had in Kowloon was with other units, you know, with other regiments, really.
Who in particular?
Well, anyone that sort of didn't like us, sort of thing, you know, or if we didn't like them, you know, it sort of didn't have to have much of a reason, really. Drink was usually the reason.
And what sort of fights? I mean, how bad?
Well, it'd start off. Two people usually at the bar or at a table would fall out. A pal would join in, another pal would join in, and, you know, and so on.
And were you ever involved in such things?
Yeah, we got in a bit of a scrabble one Saturday afternoon, but I sort of slipped and got more or less knocked down some stairs, and I kept going. I thought, you know, I'm not going to run back for more, you know. And because the other thing about it was, we were allowed to wear civilian clothes in Hong Kong. You know, the weekend we could sort of, as long as you wore a long sleeve shirt.
This is off duty, or just when you're in town? I mean, not.
Well, no, you could leave the camp like that, you know, in a pair of trousers, shirt, and a tie, and your money, you know.
Did you prefer that to wearing uniform? Outside of camp.
Yeah, I think you did really at the time, because I mean we'd been in uniform for nearly 2 years, you know, and to put a white silk shirt on, you know, then that was quite a luxury after a thick old khaki thing, you know.
But you still had to be smart, I presume.
We had to have your sleeves done up, and you had to wear a tie, and your shoes had to be clean, and you went into the guard room before you got through the gate. Oh yes, there was always standards, you know. Always standards.